Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure as a member of the Robbins family to introduce the third of the Robbins lectures by Stanley Fisher, former Deputy Managing Director of the IMF. And in his concluding lecture, he's going to talk about the reform of the IMF. Now, this is a great topic, and I'd like to launch it with a famous saying of Keynes. One always has to start with a saying by Keynes. I don't know if he said this to Lionel Robbins, but he said it to a lot of people. He said, well, to understand this system we've created at Bretton Woods, you have to realize that the fund is a bank and the bank is a fund. Now, I do recommend that to all LSE examiners as an exam question comment. And no doubt Stanley will be commenting on that and related issues. But before handing over, I'd just also like to recall that in 1994, some of us went to a great conference in Washington, summoned by Paul Volcker, 50th anniversary of Bretton Woods, and there was a great Bretton Woods committee report about how we should reform the system. And I'm the only person I've ever met who still has a copy of this. It must be gathering dust in the IMF and World Bank libraries, but it was a very good document, and I hope Stan will revisit it and other ideas as to how we should reform the international monetary system, because it sure as hell needs it. Stanley.
Thanks very much, Christopher. Actually, that report in which I had an article which said a variety of things before I went to the fund that perhaps I shouldn't have said has been exhumed subsequently. Every time I say something, somebody manages to dig this out and explain why, ask me why I had said earlier, for instance, that the IMF should not be engaged in the poverty business and now believed it should be, and a series of other questions like that. We're going to talk today about the reform of the fund and of the international financial system. And these are major questions, because the crises we were talking about in the first two lectures were massive. And as we looked at them and looked at the numbers and the charts on the screen, up there, you know, it all was very analytic and all that, but these are also huge events that impacted millions, hundreds of millions of people adversely. It hurt lots of people that the system behaved that way, that we were not able to stabilize economies as rapidly as we hoped, and that the recessions were deeper than anybody had expected or would want. And those are huge problems for anybody who's concerned about the ability of the economy, be it the global economy or any economy, to deliver reasonable standards of living and reasonable assurance about standards of living to the people who live in the member country IMF, which means almost everywhere. There were diagnoses about the causes of the conflict that placed the blame, causes of the crises that placed the blame in three areas. One was weaknesses in domestic policies and institutions in the crisis countries. Now, we've talked about those. We've talked about pegged exchange rates. We've talked about weak financial institutions. We've talked in some cases, the Russian case, and about fiscal policies that were out of control. That was one set of areas. The second was inadequacies in the way the international financial institutions, particularly the IMF, operated. And we've talked about those at some length, including at the end of the lecture yesterday when I discussed the question of how things would be done differently if they could be done again. And then the third topic on which attention was bound to focus was the operation of the international capital markets, Because as we said at the beginning, what made these crises different, what made them the first crises of the 21st century, was that they were the first capital account-driven international crises. And it was that feature, the rapidity with which capital flows can reverse, that led to the depth of the recessions. The rapidity with which capital flows can reverse also had something to do with the speed of the recovery once some element of confidence had been restored. But it was the the third item I'm going to look at is the operation of the international capital markets. And I'm going to end there with substance and then try and sum up on what sort of reforms we may see in the international system. Now, of course, a great deal of reform has taken place already, and it took place in two waves. The first, following the Mexican crisis, had an emphasis on improving the information available to the markets and strengthening IMF surveillance over the international system. And the issue of the involvement of the private sector in the resolution of crises was also put on the agenda at that stage. And then the second wave of reform began during the Asian crisis and has continued since then, but has a serious element of incompleteness in a key area to which I will turn later. Now, one can think of these reforms as being directed at crisis prevention, which is the best way of avoiding the difficulties caused by a crisis, and at crisis response. What do you do when, despite whatever you may have tried, the crisis breaks out? And I'll talk first about crisis prevention and then crisis response, and then turn to the capital markets. And in crisis prevention, let me begin with the topic we've implicitly discussed at some length, that of improving policies and institutions in countries that are emerging market countries. And that's a group of about 20, 25, nobody's quite sure how to define them, countries that operate in the developing countries that operate in the international capital markets. I should say, incidentally, that one of the things that is not discussed in the current debate over reforming the international financial system is how to treat the poorer or the poorest of the poor countries. This is very much, the debate on reform is very much about those countries that are participating in the global financial system, which means basically emerging market and industrialized countries. And the emphasis is not on what should be done for the poorest countries, on debt relief, on other elements. So that's not what we'll be talking about today. Much of what I would have said on fiscal policy in discussing how countries need to strengthen their policies, you've heard already, and I won't go through it, but I would want to make one more point. And it is that the interest rates that are paid by emerging market countries, the real interest rates, fluctuate far, far more than the interest rates paid by the industrialized countries. The standard deviation of the real interest rate paid by the United Kingdom in the last half of the 1990s was 0.92. That is 92 basis points per annum. The standard deviation for Korea, which is the most stable of the emerging market country interest rates, is double that. And the standard deviation for Mexico and Brazil is double that yet again. So the standard deviation of the interest rate paid by Brazil or Mexico, I may have said Argentina, I mean Mexico, is 400 basis points per annum. That means there's a pretty good probability within a year that the interest rate at the margin paid by these countries changes by 4%. Now, why bring that up? I bring it up because we think often of what are reasonable debt ratios for a country to have. And we've all gotten used to thinking that 60% is a good number. Why? Because somebody at Maastricht decided that 60% is a good number. Well, it may be a good number for a country that doesn't face much fluctuation in its interest rates. But if you are going to have a change of 4% in the interest rate you face within a year, and your debt is 60%, your budget is going to be hit by 2.4% of GDP. I exaggerate because the debt doesn't all mature overnight and all that sort of thing, and some of the and what this also suggests is you want long maturity debt. But it does suggest to me that the notions we have of sustainable debt levels for developing for emerging market countries have to be different and lower for the emerging market countries than those we think of for the industrialized countries. The second element that has been discussed in considering the policy packages that emerging market countries should have relates to exchange rate systems. And there, too, we have discussed the desirability of having a floating exchange rate or a flexible exchange rate if you want to avoid crisis, unless the peg is extremely hard, like a currency board. What all these crises taught us is that the so-called impossible trinity, which is that an open capital account, a pegged exchange rate, and an independent monetary policy, that's the trinity, are not consistent. That's the statement. You cannot do all three things. Now, you can do it for some time. You may be able to live with that combination for some time. But that particular combination, the peg rate, freely flexible capital movements, and attempts to adjust monetary policy in response to the needs of the domestic economy, is very vulnerable to a speculative attack if you are not willing to adjust monetary policy to defend the exchange rate. And we've seen that in every one of these crises. And it may be a second generation crisis in response to the question that was asked the first day. That is a crisis in which what is necessary to defend the peg is simply not politically viable. So flexible exchange rates rather than pegs, unless the pegs are very hard. Now, once you've got a flexible exchange rate system, there's then a question about what sort of monetary policy to have. And again, we've discussed that. And the answer we've given, and it's a good one, is that provided the inflation rate is moderate, inflation targeting is likely to work. I believe that can be done at rates of inflation around 40%. Others believe you have to be much below 20 before you can use inflation targeting. But I think the difference is because some who discuss the choice of inflation targeting versus monetary targeting believe that if the inflation targeting system is not up to Bank of England standards, in which you produce colored fan charts and beautiful things like that, and all these forecasts, it isn't inflation targeting and you shouldn't do it. But actually, the Bank of England's is an extremely refined, the most refined version of inflation targeting. And I mean by inflation targeting having a target inflation rate and adjusting monetary policy on that basis. And that, I believe, countries can do, provided they indicate the range of uncertainty about the target at much higher inflation rates. Now, in recommending floating exchange rates, nobody is very is able to tell a country that that will be great. When I, as a student, which is long before most of you up there and some of you down here were born, we read Milton Friedman on flexible versus floating rates. And Milton Friedman argued that flexible rates would be stable. And we all believed that. It was a very good argument. But it turned out to be absolutely untrue. And the exchange rates among industrialized countries have moved far more than anybody could have imagined. I don't think anybody would have thought, say, that the exchange rate between the yen and the dollar, two major countries with stable policies in the 1990s, would move as the Japanese yen did, between an exchange rate of 80 in the spring of 1995 to 145 2.5 years later. And we've seen fluctuations like that. And it's the same for the developing countries. Having a floating rate doesn't guarantee you a stable rate. And everybody is looking for something in between, and nobody has yet really found it. I don't think we should stop looking, but I'm not very optimistic that we're necessarily going to find it. As I said last time, this, the move to floating exchange rates, or at least to flexible exchange rates, is the single thing, most important thing, that has been done to reduce the probability of future crises of the type we had in the 1990s in the global economy. It does not get rid of crises. We will have crises arising from the non-sustainability of the debt, even for countries with flexible exchange rates. Now let me turn next to the very difficult, or at least much debated, issue of capital controls. And we're talking still about domestic policies. It is very hard to have a discussion on capital controls without people feeling that there's an ideological problem, and that overtone to the debate has intensified in the most recent discussions. If you had effective capital controls, you could actually manage the combination of a pegged exchange rate, a monetary policy directed at domestic targets, and you'd get rid of the freedom of capital flows. And when the Bretton Woods system, the system we lived in until 1973, was set up, and in reflection of the prevailing interpretation of interwar experience, the founders of our system regarded short-term capital flows as frequently destabilizing. And the Articles of Agreement of the IMF do not make capital account liberalization a purpose of the fund. And Article 6 of the IMF, which is the only thing that discusses these controls in any length, permits the fund to require a country, or at least to ask a country, to impose capital controls to prevent the fund's resources being used to sustain a sustained outflow of capital. And the removal of capital controls came relatively late among the industrialized countries, in the post-war system, as late as the late 70s for the United Kingdom. It's also true that China and India, which are both countries with capital controls, successfully avoided the Asian crisis and thereby, incidentally, provided a very important element of stability in the regional and global economies at the time. There's been a huge amount of attention paid to Malaysia's imposition of capital controls and pegging of the exchange rate in September 1998. I believe it's very hard to figure out what difference that made. Those controls were put on literally at the point where all over the region the exchange rates hit their lowest value and recoveries began with and without capital controls. And although there have been various attempts to appraise those controls, I don't think one can deduce very much from them. Now, what do we conclude, or what should we conclude about capital controls? Well, I believe in the long run, as countries develop, they will get rid of capital controls. I believe we're discussing something that's inherently transitional, but possibly transitional for a very long time. Why do I think capital controls will disappear? Will disappear in the course of development of a country? Because I see no advanced country that retains capital controls or think it should. And I also believe that countries will benefit from well-phased integration into the global capital markets. And that also implies from competition, foreign competition, in the financial sector. But that is not to say that immediate decontrol of capital controls, where they exist, is necessarily optimal. If a country has controls, they should be removed gradually, at a time when the exchange rate is not under pressure, and as the necessary infrastructure, which means strong domestic financial institutions and a sensible macroeconomic policy, as those institutions and policies take place. And once that is done, then you can begin lifting capital controls, and you should probably best begin to allow the exchange rate to be more flexible at the same time. Now, in the present crisis, there's been no generalized return to capital controls, but several countries, among them Singapore, Indonesia, Korea and Thailand, and Malaysia, have taken steps to limit the offshore use of their currencies. And in principle, this makes it possible to break the link between onshore and offshore interest rates. What it really does is it prevents foreigners from using the domestic banking system to get access to the domestic currency. And these controls have been used. Singapore used them for a very long time. They've been studied in the IMF, and the conclusion about these controls is the same as the conclusion about controls in general. They've been more successful and more comprehensive, they have been, but their effectiveness wears off over time, and the longer they're implemented and the stronger they are, the higher their costs in terms of the efficiency of the financial system. But you can see countries seeking to use these on a transitional basis. Those are controls on outflows. But the crises we're talking about were not caused predominantly only by outflows. They were caused by very large inflows at earlier stages. And in discussing inflows and what to do with them, everyone turns to the Chilean experience, in which they imposed a fixed tax on a capital inflow of a given percentage, which has the effect of taxing heavily short-term inflows, because if you're paying 3%, let's say, which is not the rate, but just to choose a number, if you're paying 3% and you bring the money in one day and take it out the next day, it's quite a high tax per day, which is the relevant comparison with the interest you might earn. Whereas if you amortize it over 25 years for a long-term investment, it's not much of a tax at all. So it has the benefit of encouraging long-term flows. Well, there's been a lot of research on that, on those controls, and they showed that when they went into effect, they did move investments towards the long end, and that was very useful, and they did help Chile separate its interest rates from foreign interest rates. But as with most of these controls, their effect gradually wore off. People figure out ways around them. Whenever these controls go on, you can talk to somebody in the private sector who will explain to you some hedging operation that you have no hope of understanding that will get around the control, and you say that's impossible, and then about 3 months later you discover that half the relevant players have figured out how to operate that route. But you do get ahead for a little while. The Chilean controls have now been removed. So my conclusion from all this is capital controls can be useful. They have to be exercised with care because countries need access to capital. And they're likely to be transitional, albeit possibly for a long time, and they had better be removed very carefully, because it was the removal of controls at the short end, where capital is most volatile, and not at the long end, that was the problem in Korea and in Thailand, and it's been a problem elsewhere as well. I will have to pass lightly over a couple of topics. Let me just mention that at the IMF meetings in Hong Kong in 1997, our shareholders, I think it's not a secret to say with the strong encouragement of the UK government, urged us to work towards amending the Articles of Agreement of the Fund to make capital account liberalization a purpose of the fund. Now, inside the fund, we always emphasized the word orderly, underlined. The fund should have the orderly liberalization of the capital account as one of its purposes. Well, that has dropped off the agenda, but I don't think it should. And I think the fund should have that, again, underlining orderly, as one of its goals, because countries will move in that direction, and far better to do it in an orderly manner than in a pretty haphazard way that it has happened so far. Next topic on strengthening policies in member countries is that of codes and standards. A great deal has been done to develop international codes and standards, of which the Basel banking standards are the best known, that countries can measure their institutions against and try to improve them and have their performance appraised. And this development of codes and standards strikes me as one of the better things that has happened that is encouraging countries to strengthen their systems, their financial systems, their systems of monetary transparency, of fiscal data reporting, of the way the stock market is controlled, and so forth. And this movement towards getting countries to accept international standards and to seek to implement them is a very positive development. One of the most important, aside from banking, possibly the second or as important as banking, is the improvements made under the Special Data Dissemination Standard of the IMF, which encourages countries to present their data in a uniform fashion and to meet international standards for providing those data. And in particular, the SDDS, the Special Data Dissemination Standard, which went into effect in 1996, requires countries to report their reserves every month with a one-month lag. If those data, with no more than a one-month lag, if those requirements had been in place in 1997 and 1996, we would not have had the Thai crisis and the Korean crisis in the shape we had them, and the odds are very, very high. We would not have had them with the intensity that we had them. And so this is something that I believe is very good and that should continue. So the first item, countries should be taking measures to strengthen their economies. If you're going to play in the global system, you need to have a strong economy. Now, it's sort of odd to put the thing this way. You would think countries would want to have strong economies and high standards and good policies anyway, and they wouldn't need much international encouragement, and so why do we do it? Well, it's helpful to have objective standards, for one thing. It's helpful to have countries discussing each other's policies, as they do in the IMF, and bringing pressure to bear on each other in this framework, this mutual surveillance exercise, which goes on in the IMF, which goes on in regional groupings all over the world, which goes on in the European Union, is, I think, something that is very helpful and that does contribute to strengthening economies. But if the policymakers don't want to do it, it isn't going to help very much to have the standards around, because there's no way of compelling them to accept them. The standards are voluntary. and it's up to them as to whether they seek to meet them, and fortunately, many of them do. Now, what should the IMF do? Well, much of what we talked about the IMF doing was discussed in the previous lectures. I want to talk about just three notions fairly quickly. One is improving surveillance, that is, improving the way in which we watch the global economy and report on it. And that notion came out of the Mexican crisis, and came out of the Mexican crisis because the IMF was taken by surprise. We did not warn the Mexicans, nor did we warn anyone else about the likelihood of this crisis. We simply weren't set up at that stage to deal with the financial markets. There was no news screen and no financial screen in the IMF at that stage, except in a couple, I think there were 10, something like that. We now have them all over the place, and we have now gone to the other excess where there are 8 news bulletins a day coming in through the emails, and if you're not careful, you can spend your entire day reading news bulletins. But the fund has these this financial information right there, is much, much more with it since then. Now, what do you do with this stuff? So you get worried about a country, and you see something happening. Well, it's very easy to talk to their policymakers. You can call them up and you can say how worried you are, and we do that. And that can be a very frank dialogue. And we can report them to the executive board of the IMF, and that can be a pretty frank dialogue. And then there comes the next question. Do you make this view public? Should we have the IMF, in essence, handing out yellow and red cards to the players in the global economy? Well, everybody focused on the fact that there were crises that happened that we didn't predict, and that if only we got the surveillance better, we would be able to predict them better. Well, that's true, and we have to worry about those type 1 errors, crises that happened that we didn't foresee, and we have to do better at that. If that was the only type of error you made, that would be great. But there's another type of error, which is a type 2 error, and that's predicting a crisis that isn't going to happen. That's a much more dubious proposition for us. And I must confess that there are crises that I predicted in the confidence, in the secrecy of some deliberations that didn't happen. And that is why the fund has been very reluctant to go out and say, we believe country X is heading for a crisis. Now, of course, if we had full credibility, our saying that would make it happen. We'd never have a type 2 crisis. But I hope we never get to that position, because nobody has that degree of knowledge about the future. And so the fund has not spent a lot of effort making these warnings public. But if you read carefully what the fund says, you can usually figure out in the language. I suppose it wouldn't be so subtle in the United Kingdom, but it's very subtle in America, the language in which we say that we are concerned about developments in a particular country and so forth. There's another type of crisis, which is a prediction, which is a self-negating prediction. What do you do with crises that you predict, and that because you predicted them, they didn't happen? There have been a couple of those, where we go out and tell countries, listen, guys, if you don't do X, you're going to have a crisis. And we have records in which those things worked. But it's very hard to establish paternity in these cases. This is a success. When you have a success like that, everybody who took part is very pleased to claim the success. I sent a little note around inside the IMF and asked people to give me lists of crises we had presented. The list was enormously long. I wasn't convinced about some of them. Namely, I thought the countries had prevented them quite without our assistance. But I was impressed that there was quite a number on them, but it's not something you're going to go and make public. I want to say one other thing, and that is, this is on the surveillance issue. It's sometimes been suggested that the fund should refuse to lend to countries that ignore our warnings and then get into a crisis. We should set up incentives for countries to take heed of our warnings. Well, that's a terrific ex-ante incentive, and something you'd be very happy to do if you didn't have to follow through. But having issued that, the country then gets into trouble and you're bound to establish your credibility, not to help it. Now, what is the sort of morality or the economics or whatever of that situation? It's there was a finance minister and a prime minister and a central bank governor who are doing some pretty silly things. Almost certainly they've been fired since the crisis broke out. And the 12 central bank governors and finance ministers of the 6 crises, only 2 survived more than a couple of months. So they're probably all gone. And you're now punishing the citizens of that country for them. Well, you wouldn't do it, so there's no point in threatening to do it. And we don't threaten to do it, but people urge us to do that. Transparency. In the reform of the IMF, as I said yesterday, this is the biggest change in the fund in 7 years and possibly in a very long time. And I believe that, in terms of changes inside the fund, is the most important thing to help the effectiveness of the fund and to change the way it operates of any of the changes that were made. And I must confess that sometimes when I was pushing transparency along the lines that it makes markets more efficient, that it promotes our interactions with the outside world, that it increases our ability to influence countries that don't borrow from us, because if we publish what we say about them, they're more likely to listen than if it's secret. In addition to all that, I think that operating with transparency and getting countries to agree to operate with transparency is actually something that promotes democracy a little bit, and that's another reason to be in favor of it. Final change suggested for the IMF is that we should move away from the system of only lending money to countries that get into trouble, and that we should deploy our resources in a precautionary way by providing loans or lines of credit to qualifying countries so that we could tell a country, if you meet certain standards, we'll give you a line of credit. If you get into a crisis, here's the money, take it, and it's yours. The notion would be that instead of having to deal with using our money as only a device that sort of helps clean up a mess, we'd also be using it to put in place incentives for good behavior. This recommendation of pre-qualification for lending was also made by the Meltzer Commission, which published a report on the IMF. They believed it was the only type of lending we should do. And just as I said about those countries that ignore warnings, their view was if a country didn't qualify, you just tell it bad luck. I don't think that's feasible. I don't think that's right. I hope we move to a situation in which these precautionary loans, and they're embodied in our contingent credit lines, become a major IMF activity. And I'm embarrassed to say I've been saying for a year and a half now that a major country is about to apply for a contingent credit line. Well, it is. And I hope that when, by the time the next Robbins lecture is given, there will be a couple of serious countries that have got into contingent credit lines. The problem with these CCLs, when we set them up, one of the problems was this Groucho Marx problem, that nobody who we thought was good enough to get a contingent credit line wanted to be in that particular club, and all the people who wanted to be in that club were not good enough to get contingent credit lines. We now have somebody who really wants in. We have two who really want in, and who should be in, and we'll hope that works out reasonably soon. Let me come now to the issue of how the... I've talked so far about how to help prevent crises, and there's just a lot of little things. They're not little, but there is a lot of detail in that. I'd like to talk now about crisis response, what happens when a crisis breaks out, and talk in particular about private sector involvement, a very, very difficult problem that has beset us for a long time now. What are we talking about with private sector involvement? Well, this term has several meanings. The literal meaning is the contribution of the private sector to meeting a country's financing needs. But when you ask what is meant in the debate over how the IMF should ensure private sector involvement, the term is used to mean non-business as usual ways of persuading the private sector to stay involved with a country in a crisis. And then there's another sense that is popularly used. Private sector involvement means that the foreign investors bear pain during a crisis. And there's some people who like that use of private sector involvement as well. But all of these senses are relevant to IMF lending. The fact that the private sector has to be involved and has to contribute recognizes that with the present scale of capital flows, the IMF will not have enough money, nor should it have enough money, to be able fully to offset private capital flows, swings in every country. And that one way or another, and one way is voluntarily and another is involuntarily, the private sector will have to provide some of the financing. And that leads to the second sense, that the IMF needs on occasion to find ways of encouraging the private sector to provide some of that financing. It's not only the IMF, it's also all the authorities in the lending countries. And then the third sense, the pain, is relevant to the efficiency of the operation of the international capital markets and to moral hazard, a topic which I will not embroider on because you can go on for a long time on that, and there are many who do go on for a long time on that, who never seem to talk about anything else. But if markets are to operate efficiently, investors do need to bear the real risks associated with their investments, and we cannot shield them from all that. Now, if not, then moral hazard, the notion that they will be making decisions based on what they expect the IMF to do in extraordinary rescue packages, rather than a careful appraisal of the real value of their investments, begins to play a role. But I want to make a point that is very subtle and I've never got across to anyone, but let me try it again. It is the following. The situation relative to which you want to appraise moral hazard is not one in which the IMF does nothing. But you need to say, if IMF operations can sustainably reduce the variability of output or of capital flows in emerging market economies, and I emphasize the word sustainably, then the real risks that face investors are those in that sustainable equilibrium in which the IMF is active. And so that if there is something the IMF can do and produce an equilibrium in which we are offsetting some capital flows, and that is a sustainable situation, and we're stabilizing the world, then we better do that. We don't go around saying the Bank of England shouldn't try to stabilize the economy, because by stabilizing the economy, it's producing the moral hazard which allows people to think the economy is safer than it would be if the Bank of England wasn't there. Similarly with the IMF, and the notion that creeps into everyone's mind that we should do nothing and the standard against which to judge moral hazard is us doing nothing is flat out wrong in my mind. And there is moral hazard in any situation in which the fund or anybody else is trying to act as an insurance agent. Well, there is an international agreed framework, which our shareholders agreed to, on how the fund should operate to ensure private sector involvement. And this all will be on the web, and you can read it in a couple of days' time. Let me go to the critical point about private sector involvement. When you get all the way to the end of this process, when you have a country that doesn't have a sustainable debt situation, or where the sustainability of the debt is in substantial doubt, because you never know precisely what will happen, when you're in that situation, and the country is in essence insolvent, and the country needs to reduce its debts, then many would argue that the IMF should not lend in that situation unless the country restructures its debts and unless it finds ways of reducing its debts. Now, that principle, that when a country's debt is not sustainable, the IMF shouldn't lend unless there's a reduction in debt, is one you abstract. You need to realize this is a matter of the balance of risks. It is rare, it's not out of the question, that you reach a point at which you say there is absolutely no way out. It happens. But what you're doing most of the time is saying there's a reasonable probability that there's a way out without defaulting on the debt or without restructuring the debt. And when you look at that decision, you realize from inside the IMF there is no accepted way in the international system for a sovereign to restructure its debts without unknowable consequences. Russia did it. Ecuador has done it. But the mess that was produced in each case was really quite formidable. And we don't have a framework, an international bankruptcy framework, which either allows a country at reasonable cost and with reasonable certainty to restructure its debts or impose a payment standstill. When you get to that point, the country is being asked to step off a cliff. It's very hard to tell a member of the IMF, good luck, we're with you, and we'll be there to pick up the pieces. It becomes necessary at some point if there's no way out. But it becomes clearer and clearer that we need a framework in which not it is easy to restructure debts, but it is easier to restructure debts. Because if ever we get to the point where all it takes to restructure debts is for the finance minister to decide he doesn't feel like paying interest, we are never going to have capital flows to anywhere. This has to be something very rare, but it should not be as difficult as it is now. I believe it's a priority for the international system to begin working towards putting in place such a framework. Now, I thought that was never going to happen. But to my amazement and with some happiness, it turned out that in a recent breakfast meeting, the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States and the Managing Director of the IMF agreed that it would be desirable to work towards setting up such a framework. And I hope work will begin on that. I don't expect it will be completed easily because it is a very difficult thing to do. Those of you who are aficionados of the IMF will be aware that there is an Article 8.2b which many interpret as giving a framework in which the fund can allow a country to impose a standstill on payments. But none of our lawyers believe that that's true. And if you actually read it literally, it isn't true. I actually find it quite useful because there are a couple of guys in the private sector who are difficult to deal with, who are convinced this is a secret weapon we're going to brandish one day and unsheath one day. And so having them come in petrified about Article 8.2b and believing they have to behave well because we could get 8.2b out of the closet one of these days is very nice, but I don't think that's actually the case. Now, that would be a major change in the way the international system works. Let me turn, I got to go a little bit past time. Let me turn now to the international capital markets and finally show you some pretty pictures. We have said that the international capital markets don't work well. Question is, how do you know that? You know, stock markets fluctuate like crazy. It's been very difficult to prove that they're irrational. One of the ways you might think that we know that the international capital markets behave badly is that the spreads, and I realize that in the first lecture I never defined the spreads, the MB spreads. MB is Emerging Market Bond Index. The spread is the number of basis points above the interest rate paid by, in the United States typically, by the U.S. government that this country pays. And implicit in these spreads, and the spreads are down here, 300 to basis points, that's 3 percentage points, to 25 percentage points. This is the spread. Implicit in these spreads is an assumption that the country is going to default one of these days. Why is the country paying so much more? Well, maybe they won't pay, and we better get higher interest so we can figure that out. Up here is the probability that the country is going to default. That is implied by the spread on the bond. You have to make assumptions to get these things, to back them out. And the probability depends on how much you think you'll get when the country defaults. That curve assumes you'll get 60% of the face value of the debt. This one assumes you'll get 40% of the face value of the debt. Now, why do I put this complicated picture on the board? Because it can tell you at various levels of the spread what is the probability implicit, or the expectation of default implicit in the spreads. Well, let's suppose the recovery value is 60 and the spread is 800 basis points. They're paying 8 percentage points, 8% more than the U.S. What is the probability of default? It's about 23% per annum, which means a country with a spread of 800 would default on average every 4 years or so. If the recovery value was 40, it would be about 18% the probability of default, so they do it about every 6 years. Countries don't default that often. And so the markets are pricing a much higher probability of default based on this calculation, and there are assumptions here which may be invalid, a much higher probability of default than seems to happen in practice. That's one piece of evidence that these markets may not operate perfectly. Another is, I believe, the contagion that is seen in the emerging markets. And there's an element of the contagion in emerging markets which I think is perverse if those markets are regarded as operating efficiently. You asked after the Russian crisis, why did the Russian crisis hit Mexico so hard? The answer was, Mexico has very deep capital markets and liquid ones among emerging markets. And when Russia went south, we needed cash to redeem emerging market claims. You know, everybody would be getting out of the emerging market bond fund at that point. Well, where could we get cash? In Mexico. So who do you hit hardest? You hit the guys who are behaving best because they have the best capital markets. Well, is that efficient? No, it's because, at least I don't think it is, it's because you're treating all emerging markets as one country, I mean as one group. And there's somebody there who says, aha, Russia, it means Mexico. And out comes their money. And that doesn't strike me as very efficient. And I must say, the more I've thought about this issue, the less I'm enthusiastic about the concept of emerging markets as an asset class, because that means if you talk of them as an asset class, you're creating contagion within that class automatically, and it's not obvious that that's an efficient way of doing business. Now, the last piece of evidence I did not come out exactly as I expected, so let me look at it. I don't know if you can read this, but let me read out what we're seeing. This is the spreads for the emerging market countries as they were on the 10th of September this year, and as they were just under a week ago, last Friday, what the spreads are. The average is 1,000 basis points now, 10%. That, with a recovery value of 60%, is a probability of something like 1 in 3 of default. But if you look at the individual countries, you'll find that actually there are some emerging market countries that are not being treated too badly at all. South Korea, 150 basis points. That's not huge, even now. Poland, not huge. Mexico, much better than a few years ago. And so you go down this list and you say, well, it's more or less understandable. And the ranking is more or less right. Argentina, Nigeria, Ecuador at the end. There are a couple of countries there that I personally believe on my analysis of the fundamentals to be mispriced. I discussed this with some of you in the audience yesterday. I don't know why Turkey is so high. I note that Turkey's come down since September the 10th, despite September the 11th. But that has more to do about beliefs about what the IMF and the rest of the world will give Turkey than anything else. And then Brazil has an incredible spread relative to my estimation of its fundamentals. But as you look at this, you can begin to see some rationality, even though some of the levels are very difficult to understand. Furthermore, if you look at the variance of these spreads, it's increased substantially in recent years. That's prima facie evidence that the markets are discriminating among countries and not treating them all the same. So there's a little bit of evidence that the markets may be beginning to do a better job, but a considerable amount of evidence that the job that is being done is not a very good one, one that needs to be improved. And the hope is that many of the reforms of countries that have implemented changes will be reflected in the spreads. And this spread for Mexico, could we have the slide? These are time series of these spreads. And if you look at Mexico, you remember that Mexico was up in 1995 with a spread of 23%. And, well, they've improved. And they're down to less than 4% of a spread now. So there's a recognition of Mexico's improvement. It's a recognition of Poland's improvement, and a recognition of South Africa's improvement, where its spreads are lower than any of the others except Poland seen here. And then you have the ones that have blown up. Turkey was below 600, can't read the date, in the year 2000, and has just gone up and up. Brazil was at 400 in 1997, got as high as 1600 and is back at 1000. So the markets are not purely arbitrary, but it's hard to see that they're working exactly effectively. Well, let me conclude these lectures by quoting Paul Volcker, another LSE alumnus, who remarked during the debate over the international financial architecture that the proposals for reform of the architecture seemed to him more like interior decorating than architecture. The proposals, the measures we've been talking about lack grandeur. They don't have the vision of the global economy that the wartime generation of Keynes and Robbins and Harry Dexter White and others put in place. This is no grand system that we're talking about. It's a set of adjustments to an existing system. And we shouldn't be surprised. You don't get an opportunity to redesign the world very often. And if you consider the circumstances in which they last had the opportunity, after a Great Depression and a world war, probably be grateful that we don't have the opportunity right now. Those who want to redesign the entire system mainly focus on, shouldn't we be able to fix exchange rates among the major currencies better in some way? But we haven't found a way of doing it, and I don't think we're going to do it very soon either. There is a question for developing countries and emerging market countries whether they should give up their currencies and dollarize or euroize. I believe that's going to happen, but not for many years for most countries. It's happening very gradually. El Salvador, a very small country, has given up the use of its currency. It's dollarized. Ecuador, in desperation, dollarized. And you have countries all over Europe that are euroizing, though that has as much to do with the politics of joining the euro as with the economics of having a single currency. But I think this trend will gather strength. What else needs to be done? Well, all the measures we've discussed to prevent crises by strengthening individual economies will contribute to better performance of those economies and of the international system. So will the lessons that the IMF has learned from the recent crises. So too should the introduction of the contingent credit line facility and the move of the IMF towards precautionary lending. And so should all those measures to improve the supervision of financial markets and strengthen them in other ways. I see the major unresolved issue as being the framework for private sector involvement. And I don't believe the international system will work well unless the imposition of a standstill or debt reduction is both extremely costly to a country and very rare, but less costly than it is now. We've made a bit of progress in that direction, but we need to change the balance between creditors and debtors by changing the legal framework for standstills and debt restructuring. What would happen to international capital flows if we did all that? Well, the initial reaction is to say that flows would decline and spreads would rise because the creditors would know that the debtors had the ability to interrupt payments if necessary. But I think there's another more likely possibility, which is that with more room for more orderly resolution of crises, I sound like an orderliness freak tonight, but with more room for more orderly resolution of crises and less risk of extreme crises, flows would soon rise and spreads would decline because the stability of the emerging market economies grows and because you know that countries are in practice going to be very reluctant to exercise these options. So what should we expect? We should expect that the measures that are already in place will increase the stability of the international capital markets. And as normalcy returns to those markets, and remember we're in a period of international instability at the moment, as normalcy returns, I expect that flows to emerging market countries that manage themselves well will also be restored. And the work on developing the framework for standstills and sovereign debt restructuring should get underway. It's not going to end very quickly. And then there are apparent improvements in the ability of international capital markets to discriminate among countries. And if that continues, which will help provide incentives for good behavior, the system could be operating far better, with fewer crises, in large part because of changes in exchange rate arrangements, even before a new legal framework is in place. Thank you all. This has been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating lecture, series of lectures. We have a bit of time for questions. I'm just tempted to make the comment If you think there haven't been any changes in the international financial architecture, well, look at the amazing, grandiose buildings of the IMF and the World Bank that have gone up in Washington recently. I think Professor Parkinson might have had something to say about that, but it's all right. The institutions are not dead yet, and from what Stanley says, they're breathing new life, at least into the interior decorations. Now, let's have some questions from the floor. Yeah. Yes?
Mike? Oh, sorry, you're in charge. Yeah, go ahead.
Try talking into it. Is it working? I think you have to press a switch. Would you like to come up to the platform? Sorry, have we got any mics?
It was said that the what were needed for big changes in the system were something dramatic like a Great Depression or a World War. My question is the situation in Argentina not such a dramatic case? Argentina is in a Great Depression, and it's petrified of doing anything because of the power of the creditors on the other side of the equation. So I guess my question is, do we not have a case in point, a country whose interest rate spreads are 2,000 basis points and whose unemployment is rising to 20%? If there is to be a great change, will it involve the IMF specifically acting as the bankruptcy court, or do you see some other agency having the power to restructure debt?
Well, the Argentine crisis is obviously extreme at the moment, but it's very hard to say, and very particularly hard for me to say, how this crisis will affect the architecture in future, and how much people will focus on this. We've had pretty big crises in other countries who are unable to service their debts before. So this is very dramatic. The spreads are lower than they were in other countries when they got into their crises, and I don't know whether this will mobilize action. I'm not able to answer hypothetical questions about who or what would be involved in any restructuring of debt in any country. But there is no legal provision for the IMF to do that. There's no framework. And when debts were restructured in the 1980s, and that was much, much easier because the banks were the debt holders, that was done jointly, because they were mainly Latin American debts, by the managing director of the IMF and the Federal Reserve, fundamentally taking that role. In such complicated situations, and let me look to past defaults, Ecuador, there was no real international mediator. The Ecuadorians had legal counsel and got some proposals together and worked with their creditors. Among the creditors, some took the lead. They're the people who always do, Bill Rhodes of Citibank. Has been involved in every one of these crises. But there wasn't any large convener of this situation. Similarly with the Russian debts, they took care of it themselves, and they're doing the negotiating. And you could raise the question of whether having somebody with the necessary prestige and so forth to bring the creditors and the debtors together would help in any situation. But, you know, these are grown-up people. They can usually figure out, after a lot of hitting each other in the nose, how to deal with the mess in which they find themselves.
Could I just add an edge to that question on Argentina, because it's undoubtedly
a
crisis in the news now. Was it a mistake by Argentina to peg so hard to the dollar, or was it just bad luck? They didn't know how much the dollar was going to go up and how high and dry their exchange rate would be looking.
I think Argentina could have made the currency board work, and I think it could have made it work following 1995, and I was picked out for my use of tenses on Monday. So let me just talk about that period. I don't think that it is the choice of the currency board alone that has put Argentina into the situation it is in now. Argentina's debt to GDP ratio was 35% in 1996, and it's now 57%. And if you're not growing and you're borrowing a lot, your debt soon becomes unsustainable. They were warned at the time. A letter, one of the great benefits of the Argentine press and system is all secret communications appear in the press the next day, so that a letter from the IMF staff to the Argentine finance minister was published in 1998 or 1999, making all these points. I don't think that what is happening now is a result of a choice that was made in 1990 and irrevocably condemned them to being in a crisis in 2000. It put constraints on them. They wanted the constraints on themselves, and then they didn't behave in accordance with the constraints for a couple of years. They're pretty good at the beginning. Well, that gets you into a difficult spot. The president reaffirmed his determination not to devalue or default last night, but that means a great deal of pain, and it would have been much less pain if they had been more careful earlier.
Right. One at the back in the red jersey.
What are your views on having on the idea of having an international tax on currency transactions, also known as the Tobin tax, in order to control markets in crisis?
Yeah. Is this the Tobin tax you're referring to? Yeah.
I think the Tobin tax has two justifications in among those who want it. One is that it will stabilize financial markets, and the other is that it's a nice way of collecting money for some good purpose, for instance, increasing the flow of aid. And that if we put a tax on all financial transactions, it would generate huge sums of money. And no government would find it necessary to appropriate the money, and it could be available for aid. I think there's no reason to think that a Tobin tax at any rate that would make a difference would stabilize markets. If you look at markets where they tax transactions, and you've had such markets in the United Kingdom, and they used to put a threepenny stamp or something on a check in the good old days, there's neither theoretical reason nor empirical evidence to support the view that that would stabilize markets. You get rid of the very short-term traders, just as the Chileans did, but that doesn't produce more stable asset prices. You just only go in if you expect a bigger movement in asset prices. As to whether the Tobin tax would be a good idea for some good purpose, well, I'm in favor of the good purposes, but I think the notion that you're going to be able the two problems. Number one, if you start it, it's not going to work. Number two, the notion that you're going to have governments who can count suddenly agreeing to provide another $100 billion in aid strikes me as implausible. And that's what's implied by those who say, well, yeah, let's have this tax and then there'll be all this money which we can make available to a good cause.
Thank you. Your point is proved by the fact that we still have stamp duty on share transactions in the UK today, and it doesn't seem to have stabilized the stock market very much. Not that that was its objective. Yes, Stanley.
As a market participant, I have to agree with you about the way markets deal with emerging markets. And often, as many of us have seen, the market just disappears for emerging markets. They can't access capital. And it's not just a common creditor problem where Mexico falls because as Russia falls, but when people are risk averse, they just get out of everything they've got, and what have they got but the good countries? The question is, what do you do about that? And it appears that your solution to this social externality is to be there and intervene to try and avoid the crisis happening and to quickly get it over with. Surely that's a sort of third or fourth best solution. If we look at the banking crises, it seems that there we're better able to differentiate between good crises, which are creative, let the good prosper and the bad go away, and the bad crises, which are systemic and bring the whole system down. We didn't save Barings, but we saved Citibank. Now, is it that that's just not possible in the international financial system, or is it we just haven't learned how to make that distinction yet?
Well, the difference with the banking crises is that there is a framework in which, a legal framework in which to deal with the banking crises, and if companies go broke, you let them go broke if that's what you want to do. If countries go broke, you don't know how to make them go broke with regard to restructuring their debts. And that's why it's much harder. That's why I think it's an important part of restructuring the system and getting our ability to intervene in crises to operate better.
Yes? Sorry, in the middle, the lady, yes. Sorry, wait till you've got the mic.
Elaborate a little bit, please, on the comments that you made about dollarization, and in particular, what sorts of countries do you think are most appropriate to consider dollarization, or, you know, surrendering their legal tender and adopting another? Is it the trade share as important as the financial link? Is Mexico, for instance, a better candidate because of their financial and trade links with the United States than, say, a country like Argentina? And I'm not talking about Argentina specifically.
The question is about dollarization. When should one do it?
Yeah, just to repeat, because the mic wasn't working that well, the question is, which sort of countries are good candidates for dollarization? Is it the trade account that matters, or is it the capital account that matters more? Do you want capital transactions to be integrated into the dollar system, which is the Argentine case, or do you want trading relations to be close with the United States, say more the Mexican case, although the financial system is also getting more integrated. I think you're only safe if it's both. And one or the other is going to create problems, potentially create problems, except for this documented fact that trading patterns seem to follow the choice of currency regime as well. And probably if you started dollarizing or euroizing, you'd be trading more within that that region. But at the moment, it's clearly the small economies, which are well integrated into the financial system, which have large dollar flows. El Salvador has huge remittance flows, and which seemingly have no good reason to have a local currency. That will go first. I was asked in Mexico, so I can say here what I thought about dollarization for Mexico. I believe there'll be a common currency between the United States and Mexico at some point. There are sort of matters of national pride to get over, and I'm not sure how it will happen. I think the Mexicans are far more willing than the Canadians are to go for that sort of arrangement. But I expect it will happen. A couple of years ago, there was a poll taken in Mexico on dollarization. It's probably related to your work on the European currency, Christopher. The result, I'm making up the numbers only slightly, is that 80% of the public was in favor of dollarization and 75% of the legislators were opposed to dollarization.
In Europe, it's the other way around. yes, one there.
Christopher, then maybe some questions.
Dr. Fisher, you mentioned we could have avoided the crisis in Korea and Thailand if the fund had known of the exact level of international reserve. By saying that, you may have implied that you did not know the exact level of usable international reserve, which means the official international reserve minus, in case of Korea, the Bank of Korea's foreign asset deposit with Korean banks overseas branches. But I understand it was only 1/4, which means $8 billion out of $33 billion. as at the end of October 1997, which was only 10 days before a Korean representative met the managing director of the fund in one of South Asian countries, and actually in a few days, the managing director visited Korea and met and talked about what we are about to. So can you say the exact level of access, the information about the international reserve in case of Korea?
Yeah, the point I was trying to make was that if data on the Korean reserves had been published, the central bank wouldn't have been able to keep doing what it was doing. There's a complication in the case of Korea which was interesting. The central bank was lending dollars to the commercial banks in Korea and was counting them as reserves. But the commercial banks were using the dollars to pay off dollar loans, so they didn't have them. And so the numbers in the central bank didn't correspond to the possibility of their actually getting hold of the dollars because the banks were under enormous pressure. I don't always remember dates this well, but I do remember the Korean stuff. As far as I know, it was November the 19th that fund representatives were first shown preliminary data. I happened by accident to be in Korea the next day, and I was shown data on the 20th of November. And Kim Dae-soo visited about a week later, I think. But we didn't know them until, we didn't know the Korean data until they were way, way down. And I don't remember the numbers on the day I was there, but it was less than the $8 billion that you mentioned.
There's a question up in the gallery. Have you got a mic up there?
Yeah, I was wondering whether you could say a bit more about the kind of legal changes that you were referring to strengthen the position of debtors in the case of restructurings. I wondered whether you were referring to these so-called cram-down clauses to force all bondholders to enter restructurings, and if so, how you would make that, how would you compel countries to change the language of the Eurobonds or other bonds they issue?
Let me just explain this very briefly. The first proposal on private sector involvement, which was made in 1996, was that we should have these so-called collective action clauses in bond contracts so that something like, say, a simple majority of the bondholders could agree to change the terms of the bonds. Which would strengthen the position of the creditor, of the debtor, sorry. That there's a great to-do about all that and how terrible it all was, and then people discovered that those clauses were present in bonds issued in Britain. And the fact that everybody had said before that this is going to destroy the market and then discovered that they existed and nobody had even noticed them sort of undercut the argument that they were a vicious force in the system. But it's turned out that they, in a couple of cases where they existed, they weren't used, and that other ways around it have been found. So I don't think, and some cases where they exist, they were not usable. I can't tell you why. I don't follow these things in enough detail. My guess is you need more than those collective action clauses in order to get this, in part because there's a large stock of existing debt and you can't put the collective action clauses in retroactively if they don't exist, and you probably need to move more rapidly than that. So I can't give you a very clear answer as to how it should be done, and I'll simply defer to the lawyers.
Right, thank you. I think we've just got time for one more, and I see there is a hand raised high at the back of the gallery. Thank you.
My question is related to the question on Monday about colonialism. We read a lot in the press about the non-macroeconomic conditions that were part of IMF packages. And since a large portion of IMF money is American money, I wonder how much, say, American politicians and American big business has in the formulation of your bailout packages.
Well, I mean, I haven't... These questions are always a bit more complicated than you imply. No representative of American business showed up in my office or the managing director's office or anybody's office in the IMF, as far as I'm aware, on these terms. So you have to ask, what influence does the business sector have on U.S. government policy? And U.S. government policy is important in the IMF. It is the largest shareholder in the fund. The rule of IMF politics is that it's very easy to block big changes for almost anybody. Everybody focuses on the fact that we need an 85% majority for many changes and that the U.S. has 17% of the vote. There's another implication of an 85% majority. It is that any group of countries who amount to 15% can block a major change, and the developing countries have 30% of the vote. So that particular provision is not by any means as asymmetric as it seems. But if the G7, not the United States, if the industrialized countries are operating together and want something major to happen, they could possibly force it through with a bit of help. But here's a fact that is not generally known but is absolutely true. There is hardly ever such a situation in the board of the IMF. We had a transparency revolution in the IMF in which there was no stage that I recall at which things were rammed down the throats of developing countries, many of whom were opposed to transparency. And it is very, very, very rare indeed that the board of the IMF takes a vote or doesn't agree things by unanimity. There's a tremendous desire in that board to reach a consensus rather than to operate by deploying the vote. Now, in the heat of a crisis, do particular countries speak more to the people working on a country? Yes, almost certainly. But if you look at the number of structural provisions that we put on the board yesterday, you will see that only in the Indonesian case, it seems to me, and the Russian case, were there a lot of structural conditions. In the Russian case, they should have been there. In the Indonesian case, most of them should be there. If you look at the ones where there could have been commercial interests, I don't think there was any great enthusiasm out in the outside world for buying the clove industry or the plywood industry in Indonesia. There were provisions on liberalization of the automobile markets in Indonesia, another source of corruption. The United States was not the only country that had an interest in that particular liberalization. So, you know, when countries come to vote, they have many, many motives. And I couldn't rule out that in some of the provisions there was a U.S. business-driven interest. I could also not rule out the possibility that a country that has generally believed in trade liberalization was pursuing trade liberalization.
Thank you very much. Well, there, I'm afraid we must close this fascinating lecture. We could have gone on having questions and discussion for a long time. But I'd just like to comment in conclusion how very successful on the figures we've been shown the IMF's moves to resolve these crises were. In almost every case, you had a year of pain, then the situation turned round, the countries got back onto the growth path. And I think the speed with which the remedies operated, which of course always has been the object of the IMF, quick in and out, it does seem to be a tribute both to the institution and to the expertise of people like Stanley Fisher who were taking the decisions. So I'd ask you all to show your appreciation once again. Could you please remain seated and allow the lecturer to leave the hall? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks also to the members of the Robbins family, Lord Robbins' son and daughter, who are in the audience, and his son-in-law, who is also. I'm not sure if he's in the audience, but he's here anyway.